As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager. Hey, Robert, have you ever had any, like, extensive dental work done before?
Any kind of dental work feels extensive.
That's true, yeah.
A little bit here and there, I guess. It's always a weird issue for me because my dad was a dentist.
I didn't know that. Okay.
At least for a few years there, when I had my wisdom teeth yanked out.
Yeah.
It was in this super weird kind of headspace about it because for most of my life, my dad had been my dentist. And so I'm kind of getting these weird, like, illogical feelings of, like, you can't be my dentist. You're not my dad.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing going on. It sucks to have your teeth worked on.
Yeah. And well, that's a perfect sort of allegory, actually, because, you know, what we're going to be talking about today is the cultural ramifications and connections to modifying your teeth.
Yeah.
In my case, I haven't had a ton done, but I did have my wisdom teeth taken out as well in my early 20s, and it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, I was a poor college student at the time, and I, like, had the procedure done, and I woke up and was just, like, bleeding everywhere, and my girlfriend at the time had to take me back to her place where I was supposed to, like, rest up for 2 days, uh-huh. You know, and it's just, I wasn't, like, equipped maturity wise to deal with that kind of a procedure. And, like, weeks later, like, I forget what they call it in dental practice, but, like, fragments of tooth would, like, work mm-hmm. their way up through my gums. It was horrifying.
Yeah. When I had mine out, my wife, picked me up, from the procedure and almost fainted when I took the bloody gauze out and changed it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's the weirdest is the mm-hmm. bloody gauze. So we're going to be talking about the body modification of teeth in various cultures around the world.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good starting point for us to sort of compare our own dental horror stories in Western culture because it's fairly similar, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's an area where a lot of people have a lot of well-deserved anxiety. And not only because dental surgery kind of sucks and dental pain sucks, but also because these are the only teeth you have. And when you start having problems with them, it's this damning reminder of your mortality.
Yeah.
I think it was Tina Fey in her autobiography. She had this great line that I remember above all else in that book. She says, the mouth dies first. Talking about just as you get older and, like, not even necessarily procedures you have to have done, but just like dealing with, like, the breath of an older person. You know, it's like, oh, my breath smells so bad in the morning. What's going on?
Yeah.
And it's this feeling that the rest of me still feels young, but my teeth, are on this irreversible path to the grave.
Well, Tina Fey then would probably understand some of the cultures we're going to talk about today, especially when it comes to tooth extraction, and which is also referred to as ablation, and the idea that, you know, by preemptively yanking them out of your head, you're sort of cutting off disease at the pass.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about different cultural rituals and practices that involve the shaving of teeth, the filing of teeth, the sharpening of teeth, the removal of teeth. But before we even get into the details of any of these practices, I think it's important to really connect those practices to our modern dental obsessions.
Yeah.
And we have a wonderful quote here that you're about to read, and it's from one of the sources that we use on this episode, The Cultural Modification of Teeth by Clark Johnson, DDS, PhD.
Yeah, he really nailed it, and I think that it provided an excellent overview that seemed to be mostly for people in school for dental practice, but giving them an idea of, you know, what's out there on a larger scale. Okay, so he says, an alien visitor to Earth might describe a tooth-related cult now common in many industrialized societies. The people believe in the tooth cult so unquestionable, they call the holy doers doctor. The cult requires an initiation wherein the holy material objects are fastened to their teeth. Then they go through to two difficult years of trial until they emerge purified and the holy material objects are taken off in a rite of passage. These people live in a society that admires what it sees on billboards, in magazines, and a mystical place they call Hollywood. Both believers and priests learn their ideals there. The practitioners of the cult have an obsession with lines and angles. I really like that. And I think that it's an important distinction for us to set up too as Westerners. And we may have some listeners out there who are familiar with some of these cultures that we're going to be talking about. But as Westerners, we mess around with our teeth just as much as some of this stuff that we're about to talk about that's going to seem weird and sort of cultish, right?
Yeah. I mean, especially when you look at the cult of the Hollywood smile, like how much time and energy goes into the straightening, whitening, not only just the physical manipulation of the teeth, but then placing, essentially fake teeth over those teeth and sculpting them down and just getting everything perfectly lined up for that magazine-worthy smile.
So before we dive into the first chunk here where we're going to talk about everything except for the extraction, let's remind you, the listener out there, if you're new to the show, there's a bunch of stuff that we do other than just podcasting. So Stuff to Blow Your Mind is Robert, myself, and Joe McCormick, and we podcast, but we also do videos. We also write articles. We all work out of How Stuff Works. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, where we're all Blow the Mind as our handle. And we curate throughout the week various weird science, kind of bizarre oddity articles, as well as our own content. And StuffToBlowYourMind.com is the mothership where you can find most of that content, right?
Yeah. So let's get down to it. Let's just start with teeth. What are some of the main reasons we have teeth to begin with?
Yeah, well, you know, when we think about it, the essential functions for our teeth are mastication, speech, and then there's the aesthetic part, right?
Right.
And, you know, here in Western society, I know that most of us worry about the whiteness of our teeth or the shape of our teeth or how they smell, right? All of those kinds of things. But there are also anthropological, what are referred to as paramasticatory functions of teeth. And this is where teeth are altered by intent or sometimes in what's called like an unconscious accident or maybe some kind of behavioral result, right? Now, okay, you might be reeling from this idea already. You might be one of those people who doesn't like going to the dentist and there's that, you know, there's that special kind of dentist.
As opposed to that type of
the person who loves it.
Right?
Yeah. you know what I mean? Isn't there like a particular kind of dentist you can go to if you have a little bit of trauma associated with dental practice that's like quiet and they play soft music and they're like very gentle about the way they go about things? I forget what, there's a name for it, but I've read about it before. Mm-hmm. But so if you're that, you know, type of patient for dentists, you might be reeling from this idea already about body modification culture in general, especially when it comes to your mouth.
Yeah, like I know, having read a lot of Stephen King, especially in my like junior high and teen years, I feel like that was something King would come back to time and time again, this image of an individual with sharpened teeth.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, it's like they've completely given themselves over to some sort of animalistic quality, and at the same time, it's irreversible, right? How could you do
right.
that to your teeth?
Yeah, and you know, there's our fascination with vampires. Mm-hmm. There's just the idea of exactly like kind of what you're mentioning, like the canine teeth of the human being, is sort of a representation of our primal nature, right?
Yeah. Because, of course, we have teeth for tearing, teeth for mm-hmm. crushing, all important for our omnivorous diet.
Yeah.
And then also it's worth noting that, you know, historically teeth have come in handy for tool use. We don't recommend it, but
yeah.
They can be used as a tool.
And that's another way they can be altered for sure, right? Mm-hmm. If you're, like, chewing on rope or something like that.
Right. But then also, you know, self-defense mm-hmm. situations as well. As a last ditch scenario, humans can bite.
So what the important thing to remember here as we're going over this is that, you know, teeth are artifacts of human behavior, just in the same way as like our clothing are. Mm-hmm. And as such, we modify them in ways to communicate with others non-verbally. My experience in communications theory is this is referred to as artifactual communication, right? So whereas like we might brush our teeth or wear braces or whiten our teeth or something like that, in other societies, they're drilling holes into their teeth and mounting jewels in them, or they're dyeing them black, right? Or they're ripping them out of their gums. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. One theory about this is that it's a form of costly signaling theory. And this theory argues that in certain cultures, individuals employ what are usually costly, you know, monetarily wise, mm-hmm. signals that help one receive rewards, and usually that's in the form of a mate.
Okay. So this is the kind of thing you would see if you went down to the beach and you saw, right. say, a dude who's really put in a lot of time and money on his physique, and maybe he's covered with a bunch of tattoos to boot.
Exactly, yeah. And even to some Western dentists, these practices that we're going to talk about today are going to seem totally weird and maybe unhealthy in some situations too, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have to remember that our own traditions are considered absolute in our culture, and our ideas about teeth are just as culturally determined as, say, the Balinese or the Acadian, French-Canadian population we're going to talk about today. So, okay, let's get into it. We've got chipping, filing, staining, banding, jewel inlays. Let's start with how human beings modify their teeth.
All right. So what are some of the earliest known examples of this when we look back at the archaeological data?
So the oldest known example are the Etruscans, and this is in 7th century BCE. They took flat gold bands and they would hold their real teeth or sometimes fake teeth in place with these gold bands in their mouths. Now, only women wore these devices, and the surviving pieces have been found in dig sites in the Italian region of Lazio. It's thought that these generally denoted wealth and some kind of high status, because those were the kind of grave sites that they were found in. But there's also been examples from ancient cultures of covering your teeth in gold everywhere from Rome to China. So that's a fairly common thing. That goes back a while. It's not just like a new fad.
And of course, yeah, and to your point, continues on to this day.
Yeah.
So it's just a perfectly human obsession since time out of mind.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like the current culture of like caps and grills is especially like similar to these kinds of things. And here in Atlanta, I mean, just downtown Atlanta, there's several places. I used to work down there when I was working at the university. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of places where you can just walk in and get your grills set up. So it is a, you know, common cultural phenomenon today as well with gold inlays.
Now, one of the examples of dental modification that I've found particularly fascinating and have blogged on in the past is a Balinese tooth filing. So this takes place on the Indonesian island of Bali. And this is in this particular society, it's those carnivorous teeth that we've touched on already, the canines and the incisors. So these are viewed as sort of, you know, bestial teeth, as representing the bestial nature of humanity. And so here we find tooth filing as a rite of passage into adulthood and a key indicator of social, aesthetic, and spiritual well-being.
Okay, and the key here is that they're not filing their teeth into points. They're actually filing them down so they're flatter, right?
Right. It's almost, to create a more, vegetarian dental arrangement.
Yeah.
Yeah, they smooth away the fang-like qualities of the human teeth, and in doing so, they smooth away the savage aspects of their soul. That's the approach here. And ideally, the ritualized procedure is performed by a Brahmin priest, though you can actually get your local Balinese dentist to manage it as well. And if you can't afford tooth filing, this is amazing. They are charitable organizations, or you may be able to get a sponsor, an individual to sponsor you so that you can receive the procedure. Like that's the, wow. the cultural weight that it
yeah.
has.
Yeah. So it's that important to their yeah. society. And so from what I was reading, my understanding was that this is a practice that has both localized traditional history, but then it also has some Hindu religious qualities that got merged into it when Hinduism became popular in the region.
Yeah, it's an ancient custom, predates Hinduism's arrival on the island in the 5th century BCE. And is often, is the case, the old ways merge with the new ways, and it becomes this, this hugely important thing. So important that if you die with unmodified teeth, then the teeth of your corpse can even be filed down to ensure your passage into the spirit realm.
And you probably don't need a specialist for that. At that point, they can just have, like your brother can do it.
Yeah, I'm guessing maybe it requires a little less care and finesse. The symbolic power of this is pretty crazy, too, because if anyone out there is familiar with Balinese art, then I should be able to just say Balinese art, and you should get certain pictures of their more common motifs in your mind. Particularly you see this, there's a character named Boma, the son of the earth, and he wards off evil spirits.
Okay.
And he looks like some sort of a demon to sort of Western eyes, and he has these big, fangs and all. According to British anthropologist Anthony Forge.
That's a great name for an anthropologist,
it is.
By the way.
Yeah, the Forge of anthropology here. Mm-hmm. He's noted that this dental obsession manifests itself in the art. And so you see the teeth of supernatural entities such as the gods and spirits take on exaggerated bestial form, giant canines, to symbolize the opposite of desired human qualities.
Okay, I'm thinking of tribal masks that I've seen from certain Pacific Island cultures.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of, huge fangs, big smile. It's beautiful stuff. Yeah. But it's interesting how in looking at the way that the teeth of their spirits are represented in their art, that reflects too in their body modification and the alteration of their teeth for purely aesthetic, spiritual, and, and cultural reasons.
Yeah, that makes sense. And there's a couple of other examples that we're going to talk about in the episode today where that's similar, and the deification of the teeth shows up in visual representations of gods or myths.
Yeah.
Okay, well, another brief look here at some people who file their teeth for dental modification is the Iban people of Borneo, and they further beautify their teeth they both blacken and file it, but then what they do is they drill a hole in the middle of each tooth and then place a brass stud in this hole.
Huh.
So every tooth has a tiny little brass stud in its center. Also, the Moi people of Vietnam, they have their incisors chipped and ground down to the gum line. And this is something that was deliberately done in terms of staining.
Yeah.
Back when this is before it was Vietnam, when it was referred to as French colonial Annam. I think I'm saying that right. And every person was expected to have their teeth blackened by what was, quote, a very painful process.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of us who are afraid of going to the dentist, can you imagine just, somebody going at you with, in a lot of cases, these are just with stones. That's how they're filing their teeth down. And then the blackening usually occurs with some kind of combination of charcoal or plants.
Yeah, they're actually one of the practices in modern Myanmar. is the chewing of particular, root substances to blacken.
To help blacken. Yeah. Well, the moi did it as like a beautification thing, basically. And the idea was that if you didn't do it, you weren't an adult and you couldn't get married. Mm-hmm. So nobody, again, like it's our version of the Hollywood smile, right? Like they weren't considered on equal level of maturity until they had done this. And some tribes even gave their lower jaws like a saw shape with the filing combination. So that's kind of interesting. And then Mesoamerican teeth filing, there was a lot more research on this from what I could find. But basically it's a combination of the filing, crosshatch designs, like carving crosshatches into your teeth, and then the jewel inlays as well. So this was frequent in young adults in what is referred to as late classic Mayan sites. And I went and looked that up to give us some kind of placement here in history. It's around AD 550 to 830, okay? Many investigators believed at the time that dental mutilation correlated with high social position. So we're seeing a theme here, right? This seems to be going along with almost all of these. It's a social status.
Yeah, thing. You need to be able to pay a doctor / artisan to transform your teeth into the desired form, which is the same thing that we have today.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a collection actually at the Instituto Nacional de Antropología e Historia in Mexico City, where they have 1,212 teeth. That's a very specific amount of teeth from this period of time. But yeah, mainly these were filed down with stones. The crosshatch patterns were carved into what's referred to as the labial surface of the tooth, and then they would put in jewel incrustation or inlays. They're basically grills that aren't removable, and they would use all kinds of different stones for this. They used pyrite, jadeite, turquoise, hematite, serpentine, mother of pearl, cinnabar, or gold set into the surface of the teeth. The most popular and common were the iron, pyrite, and the jade, though. And the way that they did this, this is the part that's crazy to me. Like, I normally don't have any problems when I go to the dentist. I'm pretty cool with them, you know, doing all the stuff in there, and they've got the little suction hose.
Just lie
and
back and stare at the ceiling.
Yeah, for the most part.
Or the TV.
Yeah.
Which always bothers me a little bit because I don't really want to watch the TV. I don't know if I want you watching the TV.
Exactly.
A little bit while you're working on my mouth.
Yeah. I've had people like comment like, can you believe that? Like while they're working on my mouth and I'm like trying not to pay attention to the TV. But yeah. So in Mesoamerica Mayan culture, what they would do is they didn't have the TV, but they would take a rotating fine tube of quartz or some other kind of resistant stone, and they would rotate it slowly against the surface of the enamel of your teeth. They'd add water and an abrasive powder or sand to help drill it out for this inlay. They would possibly use what's called a bow drill as well, which I looked this up. It basically looks like what you would think. It looks like a bow for a bow and arrow.
Oh, yeah.
And then in the middle, instead of having an arrow, there's this quartz tube thing that kind of spins, apparently.
Okay, like you see sometimes used as a fire-making
element. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep. And so this was probably somewhere around 700 to 900 AD. And one theory is that this filing occurred because, okay, here we go again with the deity thing. The Mesoamericans were honoring a particular solar deity who is depicted as having filed teeth. So this was a way to show their admiration for him. Some of the skeletons that are found in the archaeological record there show incomplete inlays as well. And they think that this might be because the pain was actually so much that some people couldn't go through with it, or that the individual died before it was finished. And death was also possible fairly soon after, because there was a high risk of bacterial encephalitis after these procedures. So one of the pieces that we read for this is a thesis paper by a woman named Danielle Barnes. And we're going to come back and cite this a lot. But I want to insert this here because the main argument of her thesis was that, and I'm quoting her here, since death is a possible outcome of intentional dental modification, it should be considered a high-risk procedure. So her point with all of this was she sort of showcases all of the different anthropological modifications of teeth and then says, you know, think about this in context of today and how we modify our teeth today, and that there's some danger involved there. Mm-hmm. But she does point out that things like adding grills and caps or modern dental procedures, you know, that's not what she's talking about here. She's talking about instances like trying to file your teeth down with stone or, as we're going to talk about later, you know, the extraction of all of the teeth from your lower jaw or something right. like that.
Which even today, you go in and get your wisdom teeth removed, they put you under anesthesia, there's always that slim possibility that you won't wake up.
Yeah, I always have that thing. So I used to be diagnosed with something called a mitral valve prolapse, which is one of the valves in my heart wasn't fluttering the right way or something like that.
That's why you don't love Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. So when you have a mitral valve prolapse, whenever you go to the dentist, you might have heard of this since your dad was a dentist, you have to take antibiotics because they're worried that the bacteria that they're messing around with in your mouth is going to go down and somehow infect your heart.
Oh, okay.
Because the valve apparently makes you more susceptible to infections.
This is interesting. We'll put a pin in that tidbit because that'll become important later on in the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. So, okay. So we're wrapping up on the Mesoamerican and Mayans there, but they've really got this, you know, beautiful jewelry embedded in their teeth. And then there's the staining of the teeth that we want to come to. So there's Annamese staining, right?
Yeah, first of all, there's the Annamese, who we've already covered. And then I believe we also have Japanese practice as well.
Yeah, and so Japanese women used to dye. This is a specific culture called Yaiba, I believe. Mm-hmm. They used to dye their teeth black with tannin powder and a ferrous acetate solution. And they considered this, again, high fashion, and it signified marital status. It was unknown at the time, but they also realized this protected their teeth from bacterial colonization. So maybe that's what they should have done to me at the dentist instead, is just given me like a solution of tannin powder and ferrous acetate rather than, you know, make me take antibiotics. This was also done, this kind of staining practice, in places like Peru, Ecuador, Vietnam, as we talked about, Laos, Thailand, the Philippines, and Africa. In Nigeria, some people stain their teeth with something called the Solanum incanum flowers. And those are apparently a relative of eggplants. Or they use something called Nicotiana tabacum, which is, as it sounds, an herb containing nicotine. That sounds like it would actually be kind of cool. It's like dip.
Yeah. Yeah, which, of course, can also stain your teeth. You know, we already mentioned the enemies a couple of times, but they had an interesting saying that goes along with the staining, and that is that any dog can have white teeth, which is, it puts an interesting twist on it, right? It goes back to that whole, I am human, and in being human, how am I different
from
the animals?
I have to stand out. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And as I was thinking about this, because I brushed my dog's teeth for him, and I was thinking about this, that like his, obviously, his canine teeth are very pronounced, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to imagine like an anthropological dog, like humanized dog kind of culture where they're filing down their canine teeth. It gets back to what we talked about on our Christmas episode, remember? In Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, there's the whole thing with that dentist elf, and he removes all of the Yeti, the Bumble's teeth, the abominable snowman. He pulls all of his teeth out of his head. So there's some ablation practice going on there.
Oh, for sure. So definitely keep Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in your mind when we come back from this break and start discussing dental extraction, mental illness, and science. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product, and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. And Vlastar on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So, yeah, you're probably thinking, okay, so we've talked about the ways to just change the way your teeth look. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, for the most part, that's easier for us to get on board with, because we look, again, we've already touched on how we're always altering the way our teeth appear here in our modern Western civilization. Yeah. And so we can say, all right, I would not personally want to file my teeth down or make them into little sharpened points, but I can see where that lines up with our existing view of things. But yeah. Then how does it make sense, right? How do we get into the place where one just removes a tooth or removes a bunch of teeth for seemingly purely supernatural, superstitious, or cultural reasons?
Right. This isn't like you have a bad cavity and the only way to take care of it is to yank the tooth out.
Right.
In particular, there's deciduous teeth removal that's popular in certain African tribal cultures. And it seems like they purposely damage what is referred to as the tooth germ. This is sort of like the growing tooth underneath your baby teeth, I think. And they damage that so that, it just doesn't grow in. You don't have a full tooth there. And in general, African ablation, it seems like it's kind of common with cultures. And I might get some of these names wrong, but these are the tribal cultures. Amhara, Azande, Maasai, Nuer, Bakiga, Akoli, Bataros, Bugisas, and that's in Uganda, and then the Haya of Tanzania. And so this was one of the fascinating things that I read about, and I think that you saw as well, and it was in Eon Magazine, right?
Yeah, there's a wonderful piece in Eon Magazine by Brendan Borrell. Yeah, it explores what's known as Ebino, or false tooth disease, in Uganda.
So it's also referred to as a tooth worm.
Yeah, I guess with a lot of things supernatural and folkloric, it seems like it has there are a lot of different versions of what exactly it is.
I think so. Yeah, it seems like older versions of this. I don't think that this is modern culture for them. They believed that the toothworm was a possible demonic presence that was, it emerged when they saw pulp coming out of damaged teeth. So the tooth nerves, the nerves inside our teeth, hopefully none of us have actually seen this. I haven't. When they're exposed, they have a kind of worm-like appearance to them. And so there's evidence that back in 2250 BCE, physicians would smoke toothworms out of the teeth by using nenbane seed that was kneaded into beeswax. That doesn't sound like it would be particularly fun either. and the idea here was that it would just destroy the nerves in your tooth. So if you had any pain there, that would obviously disappear. I don't think you're actually getting at the quote unquote toothworm. You're just killing the nerves in your teeth so you can't feel anything.
Right. And in this, you know, we're kind of getting to the root, if you will, of this, of this scenario, because we're going to talk about some of the more, you know, elaborate and to our eyes, you know, nonsensical versions of it. But at heart, you're dealing with somebody in an older time with limited resources and understanding, trying to address physical pain, trying to deal with dental anomalies and address them surgically. But as Brendan Burrell points out, and he just put this wonderfully in the article, he refers to a quote, sense of impotence in the face of bodily mysteries. And I feel like that comes back time and time again in this extraction section for a podcast.
Yeah.
Because you have people trying to deal with this illness, deal with this pain, deal with this situation, and the best of their understanding seems to point toward the removal of the problem tooth or the removal of a problem tooth in hopes of addressing it.
Man, I mean, I go back to that Tina Fey quote that you gave at the beginning. Like, I feel like, you know, I'm closing in on 40 here and I feel like I'm just starting to get to that point of these bodily mysteries.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like, wait, where did this like piece of flesh come from? I don't remember this. Or why does this hurt when I wake up in the morning?
Yeah.
Kyle Kinane has this bit about how when he wakes up in the morning, his whole body sounds like a bag of popcorn just out of the microwave because it's all popping and everything like that. I'm getting to that point too. And I'm no doctor. I don't know. So I go into my doctor and I go, hey, what's going on? The same way these people probably went to their, you know, localized version of a doctor and were like, all right, give it to me with the nenbane seed and the beeswax because I don't know what's happening in my mouth.
Now the false tooth disease, the albino, it also ends up, you know, applying a lot to children. So you have an infant, sick infant, infant's complaining. And so there's the belief that the child might have this worm tooth in their head, this cursed tooth that could result in the emergence of gum maggots. And then this is going to, you know, just roll out of control. And the causes here can range from just, you know, infected maize to outright bewitchment. In fact, in the In magazine article, they reference one attributed cause is just passing a false tooth on the road.
Huh.
So there's a lot of superstition that gets rolled up into this. And then the only way to deal with it is you don't go to the hospital.
Yeah.
You go to a traditional healer for the tooth's removal.
Yeah, one of the articles that we referenced for this, they referred to traditional healer so many times that the author eventually just started calling them THs.
Oh, yeah, TH.
It took me a little while. What's a TH? Oh, traditional healer.
Yeah, one of the papers we're looking at, 2011 paper published in the Journal of Ethnobiology and Ethnomedicine. And they put a lot of this in some interesting context. They said that in Cameroon, for instance, traditional healers actually do a pretty decent job at tooth extracting.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the examples they looked at, and again, this was in 2011, so this was, you know, very much, you know, modern times. Most of the examples of tooth extraction stemmed from legitimate concerns such as tooth pain, looseness of the teeth, or some sort of visible hole in the tooth. And so while this paper criticized, of course, a lack of standard infection control methods and proper dental anatomy understanding among the traditional healers, the paper ultimately suggested, like, the answer here is not to just tell all the traditional healers to go away, but yeah. try and bridge the world between modern dental practices and traditional healers.
Yeah, so that they're communicating with one another and they've sort of got a bit of understanding. I remember from that one piece that, some of the data was surprising. Like one of the things they were looking at was like how often they wore gloves when they moved between different patients and were like extracting teeth. And then, but then there was other instances, I think they said something like 3/4 of the traditional healers, if it was like a serious dental problem, they would recommend you need to go see an actual dentist. Like what I'm doing here isn't going to cure your problem here.
Yeah. And indeed, to come back to the Ugandan situation with the false tooth disease, the Ian Magazine article points out there are a number of contributing factors as to why the individual would go to the traditional healer versus the modern hospital, with their sick child.
I would suspect that money is one of them.
Oh yeah, it's generally cheaper. We're talking about an impoverished region where available Western medicine is still distrusted. You have high mortality rates at the modern hospitals, corruption, expense, facility shortcomings, and it all results, in a modern health system that feels alien and maybe even a bit dangerous to someone accustomed to that culturally ingrained traditional healer system that is also just going to, it's just going to be so much more comfortable and you're going to end up having more faith in its ability to cure what ails you.
And to give you an idea of the numbers we're talking about here, so this is present day. In certain villages in Tanzania, 60% of people have their teeth intentionally removed, 16% in northern Uganda, 22% in the Sudan, 59% of Ethiopian Jews, and then 70% of other Ethiopians do this. And then the real high point was 87% of the Maasai in Kenya do this. The Maasai say that there's a medical reason though, right? There's no longer this demonic toothworm thing. They're removing mandibular central incisors specifically in some situations so that they can help feed a person if they end up with tetanus and subsequently get lockjaw from that.
Huh.
So they want to make sure that there's a way, if their jaw is locked shut. In our societies, we do the whole thing with the straws and everything, or we have IVs or whatever. But, in this situation, they're thinking ahead.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. And then there is another thing I read. This is very brief, so I don't know how much there is to this, and I'd love to hear if somebody in our audience knows a little more about it. But apparently the Damara people in South Africa, they say that the reason they remove their maxillary anterior teeth is so that they can properly speak their language, which has a lisp to it.
Huh. Though that is interesting as well, and certainly something that stands out from our other examples, the idea of augmenting your teeth so as to augment speech, because that's something we didn't mention earlier, but having a full set of teeth also plays into your ability to speak.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, another example of dental augmentation comes to us. This was actually suggested to us by one of our South African listeners, Sheldon.
Sheldon knows about the Damara thing.
Yeah, maybe she can throw in on that as well. But in this case, she was she pointed out what's known as the Cape Flat smile, and sometimes kind of erroneously referred to as a passion gap. So what we're talking about here is the removal of the front teeth, the front incisors, amongst communities of the Western Cape in South Africa. Specifically, it's something you see among poor male teenagers that are wrapped up in gang culture.
Okay.
And it's a modern practice. You still see it today. And the practice seems to serve as part of a rite of passage into adulthood. The passion gap thing, I'm not going to get into the details, but that seems to be something where outsiders misconstrue or even decide to sort of demonize it by saying that it has some sort of a sexual connotation.
Okay.
But there doesn't seem to be anything to back it up.
Okay.
Now, it's not the kind of thing that you would go to the dentist for, or apparently you could, but you might have to find a dentist that would do this procedure.
Yeah,
for maybe
imagine it's like
the table.
Sort of the difference between getting like your friend to give you a tattoo and then like going and spending like a lot of money at a fancy tattoo parlor.
And in this case, you'd spend all that money. You take as much as you can actually dish out, and you go get a partial dental insert to fill that gap.
Okay.
And here you see just an explosion of gold and bling and whatever.
Sure. Okay.
Whatever you can afford. Like some of the accounts say that like basically, whenever you can upgrade to something a little fancier, you do so.
Okay.
So here we see a little bit of the modern sort of bling culture. We see some of these ancient practices we've already discussed, where you're just taking gold or jewels to brighten up the teeth. But in this case, it's about let's just go ahead and remove those front four teeth and just get something fancy and bright up in there.
Yeah, I can, I'm not familiar with this particular subculture, but I can imagine like both how it would denote status because you're showing off money, in terms of like the particular jewel or metal that you're having put in your mouth, but then also just like, hey, I'm tough enough to have, somebody just take these teeth out. I don't need a gas mask. I don't need laughing gas.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems to be a convergence of those two different forces. And you were just telling me before the podcast episode, before we came in here to record it, you've seen some of this in South African hip hop videos?
I feel like, yeah. So, and I might be wrong here again, like our listeners in South Africa, please correct me. My only familiarity with, South African hip hop is through Dyant Word, which is fairly popular internationally, but I really enjoy them. I've seen them tour in America and watched a bunch of their videos, and I feel like I've seen some of this missing front tooth action in those videos, but I don't know if that's particular to the subculture or not.
Like with people in the background and auxiliary performers?
Yeah, not the actual members of the band, but people who are just performing and dancing and stuff in the videos.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, I know what a lot of you are thinking. You're thinking, hey, we've talked about, you know, all of these other cultures that have used, you know, ritual or unnecessary tooth extraction. Well, hold on to your seats because, when we come back from the break, we're going to look at examples from Canada and the good old United States.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and last hour on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
All right, we're back.
So, okay, yeah, we had sort of set this up as saying like, well, there's a Western perception of tooth modification that's very different from these other cultures that we're talking about, whether it's Mesoamerican or African or Asian, right? Mm-hmm. And even in some cases, there are Australian tribes where they perform ablation as well. But we've got this going on right in Canada, right north of Maine.
Yeah, we ran across this excellent paper, very intriguing paper, titled French-Canadian Prenuptial Dental Extractions in Acadian Women, First Report of a Cultural Tradition or Quebec Practice. This was really interesting. And it apparently has occurred in modern times, mm-hmm, among Acadians. These are descendants of 17th or 18th century French colonists in regions of the Canadian provinces of New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Nova Scotia.
And what was interesting about this paper was the author's goal was essentially to interview dentists in the region to, mm-hmm, find out if they'd ever been asked to perform this procedure.
Yeah, as well as some interviews with people who knew or had this procedure done.
Yeah.
Just to see, like, to what extent is this a thing and not just a matter of like an urban myth.
Yeah. It turns out, like, her results were pretty positive. It turns out that this is a thing.
Yeah. In these cases, the women undergo, or in some cases, they seek to undergo because they talk to dentists too, said, well, someone
turned
approached
it down,
me,
right?
Yeah. Turn it down. But they're seeking the extraction of all upper and or lower, teeth in order to obtain dentures prior to marriage.
Right. So the dentures are a dowry, right? From one family to another. And so they have to have their teeth removed to receive the dowry.
Yeah. It's, and again, we kind of get back to some of these cases we talked about earlier. Like, at what point is there like a medical concern here? And then,
right,
at what point does it become, more complicated in terms of cultural, aesthetic values and, mm-hmm, mate selection? There's at least one account in the paper. And it's a little dubious, but I still want to mention it, mm-hmm, that alleges that that this was a British practice by which a colonist prepared for the wilds of the New World and,
oh, yeah,
its lack of dental care by simply removing one's teeth and replacing them with dentures.
That's ironic given how many jokes are made about British dental practice in present day society. Although, I don't know how much stock I put into that.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, based on what we've been reading about the acknowledged link between any kind of dental infection and how that could, and other health problems.
Yeah.
I could imagine a scenario in which someone might think or might be convinced, hey, you've got some teeth issues going on already. You don't have the best dental health.
Right.
You're about to go to the wilds of Canada, where you're not going to have a dentist. Why don't you go ahead and get this out of the way? Why don't we go ahead and remove the problem teeth? Maybe just remove all those teeth.
Yeah.
Get some sort of dental, insert in there. Get some dentures in place. And then the only thing you have to worry about is cleaning those things in a stream somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair. Well, one of the things that I thought was really fascinating about this particular article was some of the dentists, or at least one of the dentists she interviewed, was Acadian, was from this culture, mm-hmm, and was like, I've never heard of this before, and thought that they were joking, and,
yeah,
then realized, oh no, this is an actual practice. It's just, I'm removed from this particular, it's like a niche subculture within the Acadian people.
Yeah, it's a small, rare thing, but when they poked around, they found that yes, it did occur with enough frequency to suggest that it was an actual thing. It wasn't, mm-hmm, just, a few individuals here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So the author's core argument here is that this all may come down to just an uncertain grasp of the connections between oral health problems, pregnancy, and just overall health in general. Because certainly before the advent of antibiotics, various medical conditions were blamed on chronic tooth infections. So if you can't figure out the source of an ailment and you know that there's a troublesome tooth, well, then you just go ahead and yank it to be sure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what might have begun as a half-blind attempt to ensure mother and child survival in a harsh environment may have become a brutal social norm.
Okay. So the next example that you have here is actually another thing that we ended up talking about during that Christmas listener mail episode, in relation to the abominable snowman having his teeth ripped out, right? Because
oh,
you're
yeah.
a big fan of the TV show The Nick.
Yeah, I really love the Nick, directed by Steven Soderbergh. Clive Owens is in it. Just a great look, fictionalized look at cutting edge medicine, like the frontier of medicine and just the ins and outs of running a hospital, in turn of the century New York City. And if you're a viewer of the show, you might remember that there's a character that pops up by the name of Dr. Henry Cotton, and he's played fabulously by John Hodgman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once you see this, you may find John Hodgman less funny in real life. Like,
yeah.
That's, and I mean that as a compliment. That's, he does such a fine job.
I could
with
see,
character.
Yeah, I could see Hodgman performing like a particularly kind of creepy, a doctor type.
Yeah, and but he manages the creepy in a way where it's the most natural Hodgman performance I've ever seen. Like,
yeah.
He just does a great job.
Okay.
What's notable in the show is that he goes around basically prescribing full dental extraction, for not only his mental patients, but also for his own children.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And this isn't because like he's marrying them off and they need dowry dentures or because of any particular cultural reasons.
No, it seems to be a situation where it's like those teeth are going to cause all sorts of horrible infections. It's going to lead to madness. Better to just pull them all out now.
Wow.
And while fictionalized, the writers of the Nick actually base this character on a real guy. The real Dr. Henry Cotton, who lived 1876 through 1933, was a respected academic psychiatrist, and he served as superintendent of New Jersey's Trenton State Hospital. And he was a huge proponent of modern medical practices, but when established methods proved ineffective in the physical treatment of mental illness, he turned to the bacteriological theory of disease.
Okay, and so this was like a general idea at the time that was, you know, depression or other mental illness stemmed from something going on in the body, some organ problem, right? In a lot of cases, like that I had read about in relation to this, it was the colon was being removed.
Yeah, and we'll get to that, but basically, there was a lot of big games going on in medicine, mm-hmm. and we were figuring out what the biological roots of things like cholera and
right.
malaria were. So it seemed like the sky was the limit, and that mm-hmm. If we barreled down, we could find these problems, and we could just completely take care of it. So yeah, Cotton decides to give it a go. In his day, there was a prominent theory from a pair of British surgeons, that linked untreated infections in the gums and in the intestines,
okay.
To your point. And the idea was that these untreated infections were toxifying the blood, and this could result in pathological brain alterations.
Mm.
So Cotton took this theory and he ran with it. So in 1916, he extracted the infected teeth from 50 mental patients. So these are just the infected teeth.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, takes a step back. But this doesn't seem to be doing any good. So then he goes back in and has just all their teeth removed.
Huh.
And then this doesn't work. So he continues to chase the decay, as I've heard the term thrown around and among dentists.
Okay.
So the patients have clearly swallowed tainted saliva stemming from their oral infections. So he systematically removes tonsils, spleens, stomachs, colons, the cervix.
Jeez.
And amid all this butchery, he's reporting
yeah.
an 85% cure rate for mental illness.
But how many of his patients lived through all these procedures? Jeez.
That's the thing. Because at first, everybody's like, oh, this huge success rate. This guy's doing good work.
Yeah,
and he's
I'm depressed. Can you remove my stomach, please?
Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously I can see the sort of correlation there. There's obviously a long history of,
mm-hmm.
and we think about it today with people who talk about IBS between, you know, the mental connection to the digestive system. But I don't know that one necessitates the removal of the
right.
other.
Right. I mean, the connections are there. It's just, what do you do about those connections and what kind of assumptions do you jump to?
Yeah.
Because, to your point about, you know, how many of these individuals are surviving, the mortality rate was 30-40%.
Jeez.
And so when that starts to get out, the enthusiasm for Cotton's cure here kind of, you know, peters out a little bit. And eventually psychoanalysis gains steam. But these procedures, particularly the surgeries and the removal of, you know, intestinal material, this continues at Trenton Asylum until Cotton dies of a heart attack in 1933.
This actually reminds me of something that I'd like us to do an episode about. is coffee enemas. Because I think that there's somewhat of a connection there, right? That like the fad of coffee enemas, that you feel better, you feel mentally better after you've kind of flushed your system out this way. Again, the connection between the digestive system and mental process.
Oh yeah. I mean, you can get into the topic of rectal feeding, which Mary Roach explores in her book Gulp, which I highly recommend if you if you're at all into a bunch of weird digestive data about how the body actually works and some of the stuff we've done in exploring it. That's a great book to check out.
My wife's read it, and I know that it's come up on the show frequently in the past. I need to get on that.
So we're winding down here, but it is important to bring things back around and touch on some of the actual science, some of what current science is saying about the effects of tooth extraction on brain functionality. So according to a 2014 paper from University College London published in Journal of the American Geriatric Society, memory and walking speeds of adults who have lost all of their teeth decline more rapidly than those who still have some of their own teeth.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah. As we'll break down here, it's a little more problematic.
I would imagine that, I imagine that there's not a direct connection between those things, but that there's the aging process in itself is related to those.
Yeah, because you have to ask questions. Well, why did this individual lose their teeth?
Exactly.
What socioeconomic situations are going on here? How's that factoring in? How is pre-existing mental illness factoring into lack of hygiene? That sort of thing. But the study looked at over 3,000 adults age 60 or over, and then they compared their performance in tests of memory and walking speed. And people with none of their own teeth performed approximately 10% worse in both memory and walking speed tests than people with their teeth. And they adjusted this for a wide variety of factors, socio-demographic characteristics,
sure,
existing health problems, physical health, health behaviors. Did they smoke? Did they drink? Did they have, episodes of depression in their life? Applied all of this, and they still found a definite gap.
Huh, okay.
So the theory here is that tooth loss could be used as an early marker of mental and physical decline in older age. Now, a 2013 study takes things a little further. This was published in the European Journal of Oral Sciences, and it explores sort of the hypothetical effects of tooth loss here. The research was carried out by universities in Norway and Sweden, and they looked at 273 participants with missing teeth aged 55 to 80, and then they gave them memory tests.
Okay.
And they found that the number of teeth in an individual's head, quote, positively associated with performance on episodic memory recall as well as recognition.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm trying to visualize, maybe our listeners are doing this too. I'm trying to visualize a biological connection between your teeth and the memory centers in your brain. And I suppose that's part of it, but there's also, sort of the external factors of not having your teeth and the acceleration of memory loss.
Yeah. So a lot of this seems to come down, a lot of the theory here seems to come down to the fact that the movement of our jaw and teeth sends sensory input data to the hippocampus, the area of the brain that forms and retrieves memories.
Yeah.
So one hypothesis is that, so we have reduced sensory input from those missing teeth. That could be damaging our memory. Implants could help, but they're never going to replace all of those lost sensations.
Okay. So this is like a mastication type of thing that, like, as you chew, you're receiving sensory input. Huh. Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of like you have all these dead phone lines, and that could be affecting the phone bank in your head.
Yeah.
To put it very simply.
Huh. I wonder, this is maybe unrelated, but I wonder if there's a connection between, ringing ear and memory loss as well, because that's sort of a similar phenomenon in which, like, the dead phone line analogy is a good one. Your brain's not receiving the right signals. Anyway, what's the other hypothesis?
The second hypothesis is that it could come down more to chewing. So chewing increases blood flow in the brain, and it has been shown to increase activity in numerous brain areas. Even with dentures, an individual with lost teeth is going to maybe avoid certain foods. They're going to chew less. So there's going to be less chewing action. Mm-hmm. And then that's going to mean less blood flow in portions of the brain, possibly.
Yeah. My grandmother was recently sick in the hospital, and I'm assuming this must be like a fairly standard practice for hospitals, but they pureed everything that she ate. Mm-hmm. So everything that she received was pureed so that she didn't have to chew as much because she was so weak from the illness that she had had, which was pneumonia.
Now, finally, it's also possible that people lacking teeth and denture wears, that they end up avoiding certain foods, leading to lower intakes of key vitamins, proteins, and just calories in general, which in turn impacts brain performance.
Okay. Huh. Well, I'm most curious about hypothesis one, and I wonder if there's any connection. Maybe this is just like where I'm going, but I wrote an episode about ringing ear for our video series Brain Stuff one time, and it's very similar kind of missing sensory signals there. So yeah, I'm curious about that.
Now, there have been other studies that have explored correlation between dental hygiene and various health conditions. There seems to be a connection between gum health and heart health, between gum disease and dementia. Some even suggesting that gum disease bacteria might get into the brain, causing inflammation and brain damage.
Well, that sounds very similar to the heart thing I was talking about earlier.
Yeah. And it all comes back to, Brendan Burrell's quote about that sense of impotence in the face of bodily mysteries. Like, I feel like we end up coming back to that same place of just being not completely sure.
Yeah.
How biological factor A influences biological factor B.
We're not as far ahead of the curve with our own biology as we like to think that we are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
But so I guess the question is like, let's say like we're in a situation where, civilized society has fallen apart and you've got a toothache. Would you, go ahead and just have somebody yank your tooth out and then like use like a hot knife to burn out any tooth germ that was remaining behind?
I mean, the thing about any kind of dental pain is you can imagine yourself getting to that point where you say, all right, I'm going to go to this traditional healer. I'm going to go to this guy down the street. I'm going to try something myself. Because when stuff starts going awry in there, you're going to do whatever it takes. You're going to
even further connection between, the mouth and the brain and the mind and the, I think that there's like a large connection there. Cause any kind of tooth pain that I've ever had before is just utterly distracting from anything else that's going on.
Yeah. And certainly, any kind of dental infection, if it's not treated, if it gets out of control, that can have dire consequences on your overall health. So it's not just there's not necessarily a layer of mystery between dental health and overall health.
Yeah.
So there you have it. Dental extraction, dental modification. We've taken you through a number of different cultures. We've taken you across time here and hopefully landed in a place of curiosity, wonder, and maybe a little horror.
Yeah. So I'm curious out there, maybe you have spent time among some of the cultures we're talking about, whether it's the Acadians in Canada or you're in Uganda or maybe Mesoamerica. You've done some archaeological digs in Mayan cultures before. What experience do you have with this teeth modification that goes on in other societies? Or, what kind of experience have you had in our own sort of Western, general dentistry?
Yeah. And hey, in the meantime, check us out at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where we find all the blog posts, the podcast episodes, the videos, links out to those social media accounts we mentioned earlier, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr. And hey, if people want to get in touch with us the old-fashioned way, how can they do that?
Well, they can write us on the email, and that is blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them.
Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.